March 20, 1945. The Red Army was only a few days away from launching its major assault on Berlin. It was at this very moment that Hitler called upon one of his finest defensive generals to try and hold the last defensive line on the Eastern Front. The general in question was Gotthard Heinrici. This general, who had replaced Himmler as commander-in-chief of Army Group Vistula, would have had just 27 days to prepare for the final battle of World War II. In this episode, we will analyze all of the defensive preparations that Heinrici had made on the Oder Front prior to the final Soviet assault. The first task that Heinrici focused on was identifying the sector from which his enemy would attack in order to concentrate his defense in the area that the Red Army was going to attack. He quickly began to receive reports indicating that his enemy was concentrating in the Custrin sector. These reports were identified by Luebbe reconnaissance flights and radio intercepts. Although the Russian command had ordered absolute radio silence, from time to time some troops used their radios and thus revealed their position and movements. In the area of the bridgehead, on both sides of Custrin, the Soviets were working enthusiastically on the completion of their bridges. Some 23 construction sites were identified. The Russians worked day and night on these works and brought in enormous quantities of timber by truck. The results of aerial reconnaissance and reconnaissance battalions clearly showed that new Russian artillery positions were being added along the Oder River almost every day. The general picture that Heinrici was able to extract from the reports received from all platoons, branches of service and reconnaissance elements was the following. There were no significant preparations south of Frankfurt and in the lower Oder region, but there was a marked concentration of enemy forces in the Frankfurt and Custrin areas. This suggested that this region was the main focus of Soviet preparations for an attack. To the north, in Sedan, enemy troops continued to concentrate, but with no immediate signs of an offensive. Based on this information, Heinrici decided to further reinforce the defensive center formed by the 9th Army on the Oder and to occupy the defensive lines above the divisions in the Frankfurt and Custrin sector by introducing more units. For this purpose, only two infantry divisions were available, the 5th Light Infantry Division southwest of Sedan and the 9th Fallsen Jäger Division from Gehren's LBF Reserve near Koringhall. To these few divisions, Heinrici could only add units from Bolstrom, which were still of lesser combat value. The German general intended to increase the number of divisions in the front line along the front and to prepare a second line with mobile divisions that would be able to move towards the Soviet breakthrough points to counterattack. In this way, everything possible was done to make these units more combat ready, trying to provide them with the equipment they lacked, although they were never fully equipped. The German army had been able to work on its defensive positions since early February. By the end of March, they had been able to complete two defensive lines facing the Oder River. A third defensive line known as the Wadden position, situated some 20 kilometers behind the front, was under construction in an attempt to hinder Soviet offensive preparations. Once a day, German artillery opened fire on the Soviet positions, although only one or two shells could be fired per gun. Heinrich's experience in Russia gave him an understanding of Soviet doctrine. He knew when and how his enemy could attack. What worried him most was the great capacity of the Soviet artillery, which would undoubtedly devastate his defensive positions before the assault. The German general described his approach to defensive operations as follows. We have already shown that it was impossible to destroy this mass of Russian artillery, either with the aid of the Luftwaffe or with our own artillery before the beginning of the attack. The only method we could use to reduce the effect of this enemy preparatory fire was to evade it in time. And this was, in fact, the method that the French had used successfully during the final phase of the First World War and that I myself had put into practice many times. An evasive movement was ordered to be implemented as a strategy despite the difficulties that this implied. This method presented risks such as the possibility of one's own troops being trapped during the retreat and the difficulty of choosing the right moment to execute it. In order to be effective, it had to be carried out at night, just before the enemy began his offensive operations. Although complex, it was the only viable option at that time. The planned withdrawal movement went against Hitler's strict order to defend every meter of terrain at all costs. However, this strategy was proposed and explained to Hitler by Heinrich, although the German leader had raised how to best protect the troops from enemy fire and suggested building underground galleries, this idea was out of step with the needs of the moment. It required specialized personnel, materials and time, resources that were non-existent in these circumstances. German defensive doctrine in World War II was initially based on the elastic defense developed in World War I, but it was not significantly updated during the interwar period. Wehrmacht prioritized offensive innovations while avoiding fixed defensive strategies until the strategic situation changed in 1942. Faced with the failure on the Eastern Front, Hitler issued the Führer Defense Order, which rejected flexible defense and ordered positions to be held at all costs, evoking trench tactics from World War I. This contradicted modern practices and sought to stabilize a fixed front by sacrificing opportunities for maneuver or counter-offensives. In short, the German leader wanted his troops to withstand the Soviet bombardment on the front line, lest they be able to reoccupy those positions. On the other hand, Heinrich knew that he would face the heaviest bombardment of the entire war, and the best way to avoid it was to leave those positions empty just before the attack began. It was precisely during these initial artillery attacks that the defensive side suffered the greatest losses, without this high number of casualties meaning losses for the attacker. The abandonment of the first defensive line served several purposes. Firstly, the troops that retreated before the first preparatory fire and were not affected by the bombardment received a boost in morale. Secondly, the enemy wasted part of its ammunition uselessly. Thirdly, the enemy infantry attacked an empty area and became disorganized in this action. Finally, time was gained to send mobile reserves to the place attacked by the enemy. The withdrawal of the defenses began more approximately in the afternoon, around 10 p.m., since the enemy usually attacked in the morning. This gave sufficient time to carry out the movement in the dark. The order to retreat could never be given after the start of hostile preparatory fire, because this would cause the morale of the troops in question to collapse. In this regard, Heinrich commented as follows. The key to a successful retreat is to correctly recognize the moment of the hostile attack. This moment can be identified with complete certainty by interrogating prisoners, but even better if they are deserters. Every means must be used to obtain statements from these people. The more the enemy's attack is prepared, the more necessary it becomes to bring prisoners by force. The success of reconnaissance patrols is usually a stroke of luck. Prisoners must be brought by attacks. The best clue to detecting the attack is to see the movement of enemy troops towards their starting positions. Einrichi estimated that the first defensive zone should be very deep with several defensive lines placed about 3 kilometers apart, and that only in this way could it be ensured that the units being regrouped would not be affected by the enemy bombardment. Once the bombardment was over, these troops had to hurry to reoccupy the positions previously abandoned and that now they would be devastated. The German defensive line that Heinrichi prepared consisted of 3 main zones. The first was the front line itself, which extended 8 to 12 kilometers to the base of the Silu Heights. Within this initial defensive zone, the divisions were to deploy in echelon with secondary withdrawal positions prepared 3 to 6 kilometers behind the front line. These were the positions that the forward units would occupy when the order to withdraw was given. The secondary defensive zone, known as the Hindenburg position, ran along the Silu Heights. In this area, German artillery and anti-tank guns were deployed in overlapping fields to support the forward units. The Silu Heights proved to be a formidable obstacle that the Soviets simply failed to account for in their planning. The hills were some 40 meters high and offered a spectacular view of the Soviet bridgeheads and operational area with extensive fields of fire for the 88mm anti-tank guns positioned there. The mobile reserves were positioned just behind the Silu Hills on a natural fault line between Diedsdorf and Lenn. Directly behind the mobile reserves were the various anti-tank brigades of the Hitler Youth, aligned in a third defensive line known as the Watt position. This defensive line was the third and final defensive zone of the German 9th Army. This meant that the Soviets must not be allowed to break through this position. If they were, there would be no further defenses before Berlin or the rest of East Germany to the Elbe River. Consequently, a significant effort was expended in constructing and preparing the Wadham position. The first defensive zone consisted of continuous trenches with mixed pillboxes situated along natural strong points. Most of the frontline defensive works facing the Soviet positions consisted of earthen bunkers with boulders on top, while the line of retreat running along the base of the Silu Heights consisted of shallow trenches with minimal protection. In front of the first defensive line were scattered minefields consisting of anti-personnel and anti-tank mines. The minefields were connected by wire wherever possible. Further back in the rear, before reaching the Silu Hills, the positions were little more than trenches dug in the ground. The terrain, lack of equipment, and lack of manpower prevented the construction of significant defensive positions in the rear. However, the result worked to the Germans' advantage, as Soviet reconnaissance aircraft and ground patrols were unable to identify any secondary defensive positions. Thus, Zhukov and his commanders were unaware of the German withdrawal line being prepared. Thus, when they attacked on the 16th of April, they were in for a major surprise. Heinrich's defensive concept supported the overall objective of preventing the Soviets from penetrating the German line and reaching Berlin. This defensive posture ran counter to many of Hitler's recent operational orders. As a result, Heinrich had to meet with Hitler on numerous occasions and convinced him that if he was to defeat the Soviets along the Oder, he needed to plan and conduct defensive operations in depth. Against all odds, Hitler agreed with the feasibility of Heinrich's approach. In an unusual display of confidence for a traditional Prussian officer at this stage of the war, Hitler issued a supplementary order on the 30th of March, supporting Heinrich's defensive plan to construct a secondary defensive line within the first defensive zone, which would be occupied before the Soviet bombardment. With this in mind, let us now consider what forces Heinrich had to defend his positions along the Oder River. The battered Böhmic and BFENSS divisions were not prepared for a prolonged defense by the end of March. The continuous fighting tested each unit's ability to handle the confrontation that lay ahead. In the period from the 1st of February to the 15th of March, the 9th Army suffered a loss of 35,300 killed, wounded, and missing. It received only 9,900 replacements during the same period. This reduced the average strength per division in the 9th Army to just 3,900 men. It should also be noted that most of the men were not the skilled professional soldiers of 1939-41. They were recent recruits who were either younger or older than their counterparts in previous years. Furthermore, there were few experienced non-commissioned officers and officers from previous campaigns to train or mentor the new recruits. The German High Command expressed concern that there was no effective use of infantry and hand weapons and that in the current situation of a lack of artillery and heavy weapons, it was the infantrymen who needed to carry out the defense. In an attempt to conserve ammunition, special emphasis was placed on the soldiers' marksmanship. The use of snipers became a key element of the defense, and their exploits began to make their way into the army's daily reports. Accuracy of fire and survivability became the central focus of training. The Buffon SS, for its part, also suffered years of attrition. Many units recruited anyone they could find, particularly ethnic Germans from various parts of Europe, as well as boys from the Hitler Youth. On the other hand, men from the Kramar Mari were being used as infantry in the divisions of the 9th Army, although they were under the direct control of C. Denich. According to the Army report dated the 1st of April, Army Group Vistula, which included the 3rd Panzer Army, the 6th Army, the 1st Army, and the 9th Army, had a total available strength of 270,000 men. Of these, some 9,000 men were from the Soviet Union. Thus, it was estimated that they had a deficit of about 90,000 troops. In comparison, they would have to face about 1,300,000 troops that made up the 1st and 2nd Belorussian fronts, a ratio of 5 to 1. On the other hand, General Heinrich expressed distrust towards the non-German troops under his command, especially the Russians of Blasov's army and the foreign volunteers of the BFENSS. Faced with the lack of motivation of these forces to fight against their compatriots or defend Germany, Heinrich ordered the withdrawal of Russian troops to Blasov's headquarters in Bohemia and to disarm most of the foreign volunteers, transferring their equipment to the German troops. He considered that the Germans should lead the final defense of the country, reflecting a possible bias of German superiority. However, his decisions did not affect the SS divisions Norland and Netherland that remained in reserve. Machine guns, ammunition, transport, fuel, horses, radio equipment, and field kitchens were in short supply. Gone were the days when deficiencies could be easily made up. Although the Germans increased overall production of war materiel in late 1944, they were unable to get supplies to the troops due to problems with a railway network under constant Allied aerial bombardment. The supplies soldiers received were of increasingly poor quality due to shortages of raw materials. For example, there was a shortage of brass for carbine cartridges, so most were now made of steel. Steel cartridges were coated with a protective lacquer to prevent rust that would melt when the weapon became hot from use. This often caused the cartridge to get stuck in the weapon. Soldiers then had to remove it from the carbine with a tool, often under enemy fire. Fuel for the armor was manufactured from synthetic blends after the loss of refineries in Romania and Hungary. The new solution was an ethanol blend that often caused tanks and other armored vehicles to stop at inopportune times. To be better prepared for battle, Kane Ritchie attempted to gather additional stocks of weapons, ammunition, and supplies from the various Gauleiters in his area. However, his requests were refused. In the end, he was only able to gather enough ammunition for 2 to 2.5 days for his artillery and anti-aircraft guns. On the other hand, his fuel reserves were small and would not last more than a day of prolonged combat. The Germans and Soviets did not stand still on the front while Kane Ritchie prepared his defenses. Even after the end of offensive operations on March 30th at Custrin, there were significant local Soviet attacks and German counterattacks at the tactical level from April onwards. A report published on the 16th of April stated that Soviet losses in equipment from 1 to the 14th of April in the 9th Army sector were 106 tanks and 11 aircraft. A handful of Soviet prisoners were also taken along with a smaller number of deserters, making Heinrich's situation even worse. Hitler decided to take 3 key panzer divisions from Army Group Vistula to send to Scharnhorst on the Neisse. On the 30th of March, Hitler moved the 10th SS Panzer Division, followed by the Furrier Grenadier Division on the 2nd of April and finally the 6th Panzer Division on the 3rd of April. The German leader argued that the main Soviet thrust would be on the Neisse River and against Prague rather than Berlin, and so decided to send these units south. It was a fatal decision and deprived Heinrich of the best units he had to counterattack when Zhukov launched his assault. All these measures taken to strengthen the defense could not guarantee that the German troops would be successful in repelling the imminent Russian attack. The expected difference in the balance of power on both sides was so great and the morale boost was so clearly on the side of the attackers that the Germans had to count on a failure in the defense of the Oder Line. If the enemy managed to break through their defenses, behind them were weak armored units that could do little or nothing. In the event that the Red Army broke through the front and the counterattack of the panzer units failed, the 9th Army would have no choice but to retreat towards the Elbe River. On the other hand, Hitler had declared Berlin a fortress in which Kane Ritchie had no decision-making power. Work was underway to fortify the city and several defensive rings were being built. However, there were not enough forces available to defend the large area occupied by the city, and the units of the Bostrom with a size of 92 battalions were almost exclusively relied on. There were no artillery units available to defend Berlin. In summary, Heinrich's first days in command gave him the freedom to make quick and effective operational decisions, without having to worry about the reactions of the bunker. It was during Heinrich's first week in command that he established the parameters for the effective defense of his combat divisions against the Soviet attack that would begin on April 16. Heinrich's success in ending futile and costly offensives and moving to an effective defense in depth can certainly be attributed to the influence of Guderian, who did everything he could to support him. Unfortunately, Guderian was dismissed on March 28, from which point on Kane Ritchie had to face Hitler and his top advisors head-on. Finally, before concluding the program, let us look at the distribution of the 9th Army's units on the battlefield. In the north, in the sector near the town of Fribalde, was the 101st Army Corps with the 5th Falsinger Division, the 606th Infantry Division, and the 309th Berlin Division. In total, they had about 16,400 troops. In their rear was the 6th Canadian Panther Division with 30 Panthers and 5,600 troops and the 111th Training Brigade with 33 STC-3s. On their right flank, right in the Seelau sector, the Germans had the 56th Army Corps, which had the 9th Falsenhager Division, the 20th Panzer Division Grenadier and the Munchberg Panzer Division. Together they had about 10,000 troops with about 60 armored vehicles, including 15 Panther 4s, 21 Panthers and 10 Tiger 2s. To the south, between Gorsika and Frankfurt de Loder, was the 1st SS Panzer Corps with the 303rd, 169th and 712th Infantry Divisions. In their rear was the Kermakos Division with 20 German destroyers. Together they had about 20,000 troops. Finally, we have the 5th SS Mountain Corps with the 391st, 286th Infantry Divisions and the 32nd SS Division 30 Januar. Between the three of them, they had about 15,000 troops with about 30 Stu-3s. These units would face off against the 1st Belarusian Front, which had about 900,000 troops and at least 6 times more armor than the Germans. Well, that's it for the program. We'll continue with the battle soon. Greetings to everyone and, as I always say, see you next Sunday.